I'm Eric Spanberg, in for Mike Collins, and this is Charlotte Talks. Today we're going to market, as in the grocery wars, but before we do that, it's election season again. Last Friday, filing started for local races, including mayor and city council. Candidates can enter races through July 21st. We have all 11 council seats, plus the mayor's office, and 6 of 9 school board seats are in play this November. Here to break down the races and the issues are Edwin Peacock, a former councilman and Republican candidate for mayor, and Dan McCorkle, a longtime Democratic political consultant here in Charlotte. Dan, Edwin, thank you for being here.
You're welcome.
Yeah, great to be here.
So let's start with the headline race. Mayor Jennifer Roberts, as you both know, is running for a second term. She faces her biggest challenges on the Democratic side from current council member Vi Lyles and State Senator Joel Ford. So Vi Lyles is filing today. Kenny Smith, the lone Republican in the race, will file Wednesday, and Jennifer Roberts will file Thursday. I'm not sure when Joel Ford is filing yet, but I'm sure that's coming soon. So how do each of you see both the primary in September and then the general contest when we get to November?
Primary, Jennifer Roberts already has a substantial lead in the two polls that I've seen, and actually the lead is she had a similar lead in 2015, which was running against three well-funded incumbents as well there. It's a more solid lead this time. Let's face it, if you're a Democrat, you probably voted for Jennifer Roberts 6, 7, 8 times. She's ran for county commission, she ran for Congress, and now she's ran for mayor. So she is a very, very well-known quantity, and sometimes people default to who they know. We know Jennifer. She's a staunch Democrat. She's a proud Democrat. She's not afraid to be a Democrat. And I think in the end, I think that's what's going to drive a lot of Democrats to vote for her again. I don't know if she's going to win the first round, but I think if she runs into the runoff, I think she'll be substantially better than whoever else she's with. Understand one thing about the history of Mecklenburg County elections in the last, say, since 1997. Let's pick up actually, though. The Democrats have not lost majority since 1997 on the city council. The mayorship, we had McCrory in there forever and ever and ever, and he did garner a lot of Democratic votes because he was a moderate guy kind of then. But since 2009, that's the last time the Republicans won a at-large race, and we have a very distinguished person in the studio right now that did that. But since 2011, the Democrats have swept all the city council races at large. We have a built-in advantage with the districts, and since the last time the Republicans won a mayor's race was 2007. We're going in 10 years. The demographics are overwhelming. Now, 2015 we can get into in a little bit, but that was a very challenging race for Jennifer Roberts in the general election. But we had a couple of things that were going on there. The last two African-American mayors, one resigned to move up to D.C., the other resigned to go to jail. And so the Democratic
moved
Party
up to
was,
West Virginia.
Yeah,
right,
yeah. Moved to West Virginia. Democratic Party was not fractured. They just weren't motivated in 2015. Not to say that the Republican did not run a very fine race that year, but Jennifer eked out, I think, a 4% victory that year. I think this year the Democratic Party is unified again. We have the Trump effect. I mean, leads to voter intensity. We're like, no, we're voting Democratic. And I think the Democrats will probably hold the same majority on city council and win the mayor's race once again.
So, Edwin, he referenced you twice there. 2009, you were the last Republican to win at large. And obviously, you ran twice for mayor, and you – I think it was about, 6 points against Cannon in 13 and then down to 4 points or so against Roberts. So what do you, both from experience and what you're seeing, what will it take for Republicans to fare better this time around?
Yeah, I mean, Dan pivoted off of the word history, and I'd like to look at just the history of what our mayors have been really for the last 50 years when you start with Brookshire, when you looked at Belk, when you look at Harris, when you look at Knox, when you look at Gantt. When you look at Myrick, when you look at Venroot, McCrory, out of all of those races, we've never had a first-term mayor be challenged as seriously as what's occurring in this race against Jennifer on the Democratic side, on the side that's in power. And I think what that's a testament to is it's a testament to Jennifer's failed leadership in this first term. Generally, mayors get their first 2 years to set out their agenda. But this has just been a disastrous first 2 years for her, and that's why she's seeing such serious challengers from Vi and from Joel, who are garnering very large amounts and sums of money. And we'll see what Jennifer posts as far as how much money she's socked away. But I think what you're going to see on this is going to be a referendum election against her leadership. And the three things that I think are going to characterize this is, number one, she played a Russian roulette game with Raleigh that was brought on by the non-discrimination ordinance, which led to HB2, which could be probably political science's favorite subject 15, 20 years from now, about one bad decision followed by an even worse decision, which led to a business community being very, very frustrated with what happened in the mayor's office and in the city council. The second thing is that she had a disastrous record of leadership during the riots. Where was Jennifer Roberts during all of that? That was really the real question. And what you saw from it is you saw a city council respond, I think appropriately so, saying, we're not with her in her stance, which was essentially against the police and against the police chief. And that was just the message that was sent across Charlotte. And I think what's going to happen in this race for Jennifer, much different than when I ran against her, is people have formed an opinion now. They've really formed an opinion about her, and that's why she has two serious challengers. And when I talk about that history of those other mayors, what I'm seeing is I'm seeing a first-term mayor who has done something that very few people have ever thought could ever happen from the mayor's position, which is largely, Eric, as you know, criticized as being a cheerleader-type position. She actually has hurt her city, and she's hurt her state in the process through this dogmatic approach of continuing to push the way that she was during all the saga that became known as HB2. That was you and Jim Morrill's favorite subject of 2016. I mean, what would you have written about, Eric?
We spent a little time on that. Both of you are hitting on, I want to ask you about, you know, the conventional wisdom is there are basically three issues in this race. HB2, which you just mentioned, the riots and the protests from the Scott shooting, and then public safety in general with the
crime rates doubling, murders up twice as high.
49 homicides.
All right, let me first talk about the homicide rate. I know one murder is too many. But I remember in 1993, I was a young political consultant then, Richard Venner, mayor. We had 129 murders in 1993. We were half the population of what we are now. So when candidates bring up the murder rate, yes, one murder is too many. But you know what? We're double the population. We're still nowhere near the 1993 murder rate in Charlotte, North Carolina. I mean, if you hear the press—
let me stop you for a minute. That's absolutely right, Dan. But what I wonder is when people hear that the murder rate is almost double what it was a year ago. You're right. Historically, it's still low, but how hard is it to get that message out?
It's very hard because you have a 24/7 news cycle and every murder is amplified. Every murder is tragic, but you know, we're a city approaching 1 million people. Okay, we're not Mayberry. Unfortunately, with certain parts of town, certain crimes that occur, drug issues in all parts of Charlotte, you're going to have murders. I've never known a major city that doesn't have murders. But the murder rate is much lower than it was in 1993. And I don't remember people in 1993 saying the world is ending. We worked very hard, and within a few years, we got the murder rate back down again under control. There's got to be an underlying issue to the murder rate. And in the 90s, a lot of it was crack cocaine and the sudden influence of that on a lot of folks. It could be black tar heroin. It could be a number of different things going on in Charlotte right now because the murders are concentrated. It's not all over town, and are concentrated demographically, which is something we really got to look into because that's a serious, serious issue. The other issue is, I mean, Charlotte is still thriving as a community. The unemployment rate is 4%. People are still wanting to come here. And so another thing I would say is that Democrats want Jennifer Roberts and all Democrats to challenge Raleigh right now. You know what? They're doing things against urban areas. They're trying to intentionally, it looks like, hurt Charlotte. So as a Democrat, that is not a losing issue in a primary. Now, in a general election, she's going to have to parse it very well. But in a Democratic primary, fighting Raleigh is a winning issue.
Edwin, I'm curious, Edwin, you've been through these wars before. Can you make the argument that Dan is making? Can you make that argument that essentially we're not Mayberry anymore, and so this is just something that comes with being a big city? Will that resonate with voters?
It won't, because citizens, when they don't feel safe, and that is a feeling, Dan, you know that. Nobody really follows the statistic. If you're a victim of crime, you don't care what the statistics are as it relates to crime.
Right.
But we've doubled our murder rate, and the perception and the reality following the protests that led to riots, people, if they don't feel safe, this can break and become a single issue on this. When I was talking about the history earlier and what I think could happen in this race is we could have a situation where, in this case, in my opinion, if Vi and Joel, if both of them run, neither of them will win. We will have a repeat of David Howard and Michael Barnes. These two will split the vote, and Jennifer will win the nomination. And you will have Kenny Smith versus Jennifer Roberts. We're going to have a low turnout race. And it's a type of issue like public safety where I think that, as the New York Times said about Jennifer Roberts, they quoted in the editorial that she was out to see as it relates to her responses to what was going on in Charlotte at the time. And so citizens all around Charlotte were feeling like, hey, we're all for the First Amendment and people exercising the right to express themselves, but people that are intent on doing harm to the city and doing it publicly and do it demonstratively as they did in that display, I think that's really reflected was where does Jennifer stand on this? You look on her website right now, it basically hasn't been updated since I ran against her. She has no plan on public safety. She's not talking about it, Dan, and that's the part where I just say people care about this issue. You can say that you're hiring more police officers, and you know that's always going to be a winning issue. No candidate for city council is not going to say they're for hiring more police officers. But if you don't come up with a real plan and you don't address it, you look reactive and you look unresponsive. And the one race that I point to that I think we could be looking at a repeat of would be 1987 in Myrick. People didn't know who she was, and they didn't think that she had a chance against Gantt. And then she took a breaking issue, which at the time was traffic and transportation. Again, it was related to just frustration and gridlock, and people in South Charlotte were responding, and that's where Kenny's base is.
Let me throw in a couple of numbers real quick. You guys know these numbers very well. We have 260,000 or so registered Democrats in the city of Charlotte. We have 117,000 registered Republicans, and we have 164,000 unaffiliated voters. Last time around in 2015, turnout was about 15%, about 80,000 votes in the mayor's race. With all of that as a backdrop, are we looking at a similar type turnout, you think, this time around?
I believe we are. It's hard to say. 12%. How motivated are the Democrats and this new millennial class that we seem to have a lot of candidates running in? Are they truly motivated to vote in November? We'll see. Natural registration is 48% to 22%. Democrats, 48%. Republicans, 22%. And 30% unaffiliated. Like I said, it's always a thing in politics. Who are the unaffiliates? What do they want? How do you get them to the polls? Mayoral primary, I'm looking at a 9% turnout in the Democratic primary. That may be overestimating, but that's about what we got last time. If we have a runoff, we could be – I've seen runoffs at 1% before. But it will probably be a runoff of 5-6%. There will definitely be a runoff in some of the districts. I can almost guarantee that. Going back to the riots, I just have to say that no one really did a good job. The media wanted information. We wanted somebody to stand in front of the microphone and say what's going on. And I don't think anyone in the county, city level was there. Right now, though, I will say at this moment I have a lot of faith in Chief Putney and the police force. I think he has got a potential to really build a top-notch police force for the near future, for the long-term future. But we also have to, as city council and also in the county commission, we got to get to the root core of crime, poverty, lack of education, and drugs. Drugs are the number one issue driving a lot of these crimes right now. If somebody gets shot at 3 in the morning, I almost bet you that drugs are involved. We've got to get a handle on that.
That's the voice of Dan McCorkle. Edwin Peacock is also with us here on Charlotte Talks. When we come back, we're going to talk about dark money, we're going to talk about fundraising, and we're going to talk about some of these council races before we get into the grocery store wars. This is Charlotte Talks.
More Charlotte Talks in just a moment on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE. Our support comes from WFAE members and Bojangles, featuring the new Sweet Cayenne Cajun Filet Sandwich with jalapeno cheese, bacon, and Cajun sauce. Available all day, every day, at area Bojangles. Charlotte's homicide count continues to rise sharply, causing concern about public safety in the community. CMPD says it's doing what it can to quell this violence, which seems to be conforming to a pattern of deadly force being used to settle disputes between people who know each other. Coming up tonight at 7 in a public conversation at Friendship Missionary Baptist Church, Chief Kerr Putney and others will talk with Mike Collins about the impact on Charlotte, what's being done, and what's left to do. It's a special tonight at 7 on WFAE and at Friendship Missionary Baptist Church. If you're interested in going, go to our website, wfae.org, for more information.
I'm Anthony Brooks. Coming up on the next On Point, the Senate health care bill would leave millions of disabled children without Medicare. We'll dig into that. That's coming up on the next On Point from NPR.
You're invited to join On Point coming up at 10 o'clock, right after Charlotte Talks, here on Listener Funded 90.7 WFAE, Charlotte's NPR news source.
Back on Charlotte Talks, I'm Eric Spanberg in for Mike Collins as we are talking about the city council races, the mayor's races, and the rest of the fall campaign. Edwin Peacock, a former Republican councilman and two-time mayoral candidate, is with us. And Dan McCorkle, a longtime Democratic strategist, is also with us here in studio. We're going to talk politics a little bit more, and then we're going to get into the grocery store wars. When we left, we were talking a little bit about we were starting to get into a little bit of the statistics, and I wanted to ask you about the money side. I think we have both Vi Lyles and Joel Ford have said they've raised more than $200,000 each. I think Kenny Smith said about $260,000. Jennifer Roberts has not yet declared how much she has raised. In July 28th is when all the candidates have to actually file with the elections board. So with all of that as a backdrop, a lot of people seem to think that this is going to be a record year for spending. What did the two of you see?
Why? I've never understood why people spend $500,000 to get 30,000 votes. It's the insanity of the whole thing. And it has to do with, I don't know if it's egos, but you don't need that. I've won city council races for $20,000, and I had every tool I needed. What do you do with $500,000 in a municipal primary or even a general election? It's insane. Now, I know you're going to segue into this, but I think the dark money has always been there. The PAC money has always been there. The dark money often comes with strings attached. In other words, we will give you this check for $10,000, but we're going to use our vendors. And what that's doing, it's driving a lot of consultants from outside of Charlotte, from D.C., from wherever, from whatever hole they crawled out of.
Well, the consultant who managed Edwin's campaign in 2015 is the head of, is it Forward Charlotte, I believe, which is not aligned with candidate, but it's obviously Republican-leaning, and it's one of these social welfare groups, which means they can essentially advocate for positions
exactly.
That would—
But look at why. I mean, you're talking about— You're talking about what the amount of money. I'm talking about why do we have two dark candidates. The reason that we have this is what happened in the mayor's office. We have on the left, we have a political action committee, and on the right, we have a political action committee.
One of
we have
two supporting
candidates.
Joel Ford,
we have two candidates that have already raised $400,000, and we're not even 4 months into the race, and the real money will begin after filing closes. Again, why? The reason why is Jennifer has not been an effective mayor. She has divided the community and she's divided her council. Now, that is the reason why we're seeing this. And the question will be is that will more money translate to getting turnout out? And that's
again, It normally doesn't.
Sadly, it doesn't.
And like I said, it took a state senator, of course, who lives in a world of dark money in Raleigh to actually bring the dark money visibly into town. Like I said, it's always been there somewhere.
But not direct spending. There wasn't an IRS direct.
Yeah. But, you know, it pushes candidates. People ask how you can spend $50 million in a congressional race down in Georgia that probably has less votes than it takes to win a mayor's race in Charlotte. Because suddenly you have this excessive media. Instead of three pieces of direct mail, you get 15. I mean, it's just ridiculous, the saturation levels. And Edwin's right. It does not lead to more turnout, or it does not lead to a more quality election. What I'm meaning, are we really discussing issues, or we're just going to attack each other for the next couple of months with dark money because we have it?
Now, we have just a couple minutes left, and I don't want to ignore the city council races because it is very interesting this time around. Of course, we have 11 council members. It's a 9-2 advantage for Democrats, but you have four members who will at least leave their current seats. You have Kenny Smith, who's running for mayor, Vi Lyles running for mayor, Al Austin, who's already left, and who is my fourth one, is Dimple Ajmera, who was appointed in January and now will run at large.
So exactly.
When you look at this, Edwin, there are a lot of new faces, Tark Bakari, John Powell is back. He was within 250 votes mm-hmm. of winning on the Republican side. What do you think is going to happen with this next council race?
I think you've got a stacked deck on the left with a lot of candidates that are very motivated, I think largely from what we saw in September. They want to see more activity. Dan is correct. They're more millennial based, and I think that's a positive for Charlotte. We need people in their 30s stepping up. On the right, we have a newcomer, Parker Keynes, running at large. Got a very strong number that he'll be posting here coming up soon. You've got Tariq Bakari, who ran in 2009 in my race and ran a very good race in his first election, and is back here after a break, getting back into business and being with his family. And then you've got John Powell, who's running for a second time as well, too. So I think you're going to have a competitive side, really, on both ends. What's interesting to me is on the Democratic side, you really only see the leadership, assuming that James Mitchell files again. That's the only known quantity that we see on that side. I think there's a lot more interesting things that could occur, and Dan knows that.
Dan, before you answer, I want to mention that Dimple Ashmira is a client of yours, and Greg Phipps, who
right.
is a District 4 councilman, is a candidate of yours. Any other candidates in the room?
unless Edwin announces today, as we've anticipated.
Go ahead.
I mean, the one thing about Democrats, the way the districts are drawn, just natural demographics of Charlotte, we have a 5-2 advantage. We've had that since 1999. Yeah. So to basically take control, Republicans.
7-2.
You're right. No, 5-2 and the 4 at large. So the Republicans literally need to at least win 3, probably 4 seats at large to take control of the city council. So we are securing our majority. That's just the way demographics are. You know, elections are about demographics and voter intensity. We have the demographics. The thing we got to work on is voter intensity, because, like I said, in 2015 that was way too close for us, considering 2 years previous, actually 4 years previously, Anthony Fox got 67% of the vote.
So the speed round question for both of you is, you know, how do you convince people that this is an important election? Because everyone is so wrapped up in the national political debate and, to some extent, North Carolina, the General Assembly. So how do you get 15% or better to come out and vote this time around?
I think, sadly, on local elections, people have got to have a reason to come out. And it's generally going to either be a ballot initiative. I think the one that we had that was most prominent in a local election was 2012 with Amendment 1. We don't have anything like that. We've got the school bonds that drive it. And so, again, I point to this being a referendum on the leadership of Jennifer Roberts, and that will carry on the down ticket as well, too. Again, you see people on her side of the ticket that are very dissatisfied with her leadership and don't see a vision going forward on the right. You see, obviously, Kenny Smith using appropriately, "We deserve better," as his motto for his campaign. And I think Kenny's striking a right message. The question will be, as I saw, and we saw a drop in District 7 voter turnout in my race, which was very disappointing. That's where a lot of my vote total could have come from between my race against Patrick Cannon. It went down. And we were sort of miffed by that. We worked so hard to try to find voters that generally are not voting in local elections but only voting in presidential and large senatorial campaigns. We just were unable to motivate them, and I think what motivates them is a reason where they want to vote typically against something, which is unfortunate. We see that trickling down
right.
from
Dan,
the
can you do it
side.
In 60 seconds? Tell us.
I can do it in 60 seconds.
Why should people vote? Or how do you get them to
vote?
I
will give a scholarly answer, because the city council members have more impact on your day-to-day life than any other elected official. Think about it. Mm-hmm. All the things they're in charge of, all the things they're responsible for, the infrastructure, traffic, transit, you know, fixing potholes. I mean, it's a voter education issue. It's great to vote for the president. Fantastic. But, man, start voting locally. It is so important. Another issue that, like I said, will come up will be Trump. I'm serious. Democrats are very, very motivated. I mean, they woke up shocked in November, and now they have identified themselves as Democrats. Are very staunchly Democrats. If you're not a Democrat, then, you know, we're not going to vote for you, a lot of the issues are. But the other issue is Charlotte sovereignty. I mean, the things Raleigh is trying to do to Charlotte, from taking our airport to at some point redistricting our city, I think that's on the agenda too, God forbid. I think fighting against Raleigh actually is a good winning issue for Democrats as well. But let's just get people voting locally, for heaven's sakes. Let's make Charlotte a better place.
I want to thank both of you. That was Dan McCorkle with The Last Word, Democratic strategist. Edwin Peacock, former Republican councilman and mayoral candidate. Thank you both for being here today. And we're going to head on down the grocery aisle now. Thank you both.
You're welcome.
All right. Thanks.
As I mentioned, competition is heating up on every aisle at the supermarket and beyond. 3 years ago, hometown grocer Harris Teeter became part of Kroger, the number one grocery chain. And the same year, Publix began an aggressive expansion into Charlotte that includes a number of head-to-head challenges in real estate terms to Harris Teeter. I can't read today. Katie Peralta, who is not running for anything of the Charlotte Observer, is here. And we also have joining us by phone industry analyst Phil Limpert. They're going to sift through the competition for us. So Let's start. I want to start with you, Katie. Harris Teeter and Publix, you've obviously written a lot about this, the competition. Harris Teeter has 20%, I think, of the Charlotte market, right? Publix has 7.2%. So where is all this headed? Are we going to see more of the same?
Definitely not more of the same. It's going to get more aggressive. And I think that we've seen a lot of the intensity over the last, 3 years since Publix has been here. And while they don't control a very large portion of the Charlotte grocery market, it is one that has grown exponentially, more so proportionally than other grocery store chains. So while they are pretty small, they're growing pretty quickly. They have tons of stores planned in the Charlotte area, a lot more that are being kind of just in the works down the line. There's a lot of talk about some locations that I probably shouldn't mention, but I think that, you know, as time goes on, people will say, like, why is there a Publix across the street? There's literally just a Harris Teeter a block away. And that's not really unusual because they compete for the same customers. So I think that you'll see a lot more competition, a lot more price competition, maybe. That might be a good thing for consumers down the line, you know, as things heat up in the Charlotte area and as the region keeps growing, of course.
I mentioned Phil Limpert, who is an industry analyst. Phil, for years, people have wondered whether someone like Publix would actually challenge Harris Teeter in their own backyard. And as Katie just made clear, they are. Why do you think now is the right time for them to do this? Or why do they think it's the right time?
Well, Eric, I think that when you look at all of grocery, and everything that Katie said is dead on, but if you look at everything that's going on in grocery, the rules have changed. The rules changed about 2 weeks ago. We started out the week with Lidl opening up their stores in North Carolina, and it really shocked the industry because everybody thought that when Lidl opened, it would look like Lidl is in Europe, which is just a mirror image of Aldi, which basically they came to the U.S. and they said, we're going to change. We're going to be all about fresh. We're going to be award-winning. We're going to be cheap, and we're going to be very glitzy. So that's the way the week started. Then the following day, we saw Aldi announce $5.6 billion investment, another 600 stores that they're opening. Then the day after that, what we saw is Kroger and Costco. Their stock went down, Kroger 18%, Costco 10%. Then on the same day, we had that, you know, infamous profile in Texas Monthly of John Mackey from Whole Foods. And then Friday, Amazon announced that they're going to take over Whole Foods. So I think all the rules are different now. And I think that if you look at this Publix Harris Teeter war and this battle, this is nothing. We're going to see lots of new formats happening in Charlotte and throughout the entire country. And basically, consumers are going to win because I think we're going to have better grocery stores and we're going to have cheaper prices.
See, a shameless host would say that's a lot to digest, but I won't do that. before we get into some of the Whole Foods and the wholesalers you mentioned, I want to ask you both about Kroger. Obviously, Harris Teeter's parent company. They've had consecutive quarters of declining same-store sales. After 50 quarters of growth, which is a pretty incredible statistic, their profits fell 56% in the first quarter. They've lowered their expected earnings forecast for the rest of the year. The stock is down 30%. So, you know, I guess how much of a problem is this for Kroger, and what's it going to take for them to bounce back a little bit here?
It's a pretty big problem for Kroger because it, not only are there more competitors in the space, but there are cheaper options. A lot of young people don't care as much about brand names, so they might, you know, gravitate toward like a Lidl, Target, Trader Joe's, basically whatever is closest and most convenient and cheapest. So that's forced Kroger, Harris Teeter, to be a little bit more innovative, which is why you're seeing them add different elements to their grocery stores. Like, Phil, I think you've used this term several times, grocerants, which are like in-store restaurants where you can sit down, have a glass of wine, wine bars, of course, growlers, gas stations, and they have lowered prices on like thousands of items. So it's really forced them to change pretty quickly. They, at least at Harris Teeter stores, that's what I'm referring to in the Charlotte area. They've also done pretty extensive renovations of several stores, or are about to do pretty extensive renovations on several Charlotte stores. throughout the area, just to make them, you know, a little bit glitzier, a little bit more of an experiential type of shopping trip. You know, at Publix, their motto is "Where shopping is a pleasure." So it's kind of interesting. You see Harris Teeter and Kroger going kind of that same route with the, you know, just with the glitzier additions and you know, fancy upgrades and things like that.
That's Katie Peralta from the Charlotte Observer. Phil Lempert, you want to chime in on that?
Absolutely. When we take a look at what's gone on with Kroger, it's really interesting. Kroger has a secret weapon. It's called 8451, which is a company, used to be called dunnhumby, out of the UK. They bought 50% of it some years ago, and then a couple years ago they bought the rest of it. It's really about marketing intelligence, really being able to segment consumers. So what's interesting is that was driving Kroger's growth. The problem is, as Katie pointed out, you know, the millennials and Generation Z don't see any difference between going to a store, shopping online, name brands versus store brands, and they really miss the mark on that. And when we take a look at what the future is going to hold, that 40 to 50,000 square foot supermarket is a dinosaur. It's dead in the water. It's exactly what Katie had said about Publix getting a better experience. It's not just about piling it high and selling it cheap anymore. When people buy food, they want to have more passion about their food. Walking around with a glass of wine while you're shopping. So it's really changing everything, and Kroger really misread that, which is shocking to me because they're a smart company. 8451 is a terrific, very insightful company, and they just didn't move quick enough.
So if the 40 to 50,000 square foot store is a dinosaur, why do they keep building these things? I'm not just talking about Harris Teeter. I mean, obviously there are plenty of Publix and, you know, others, Food Lion.
You know, and I'm going to say this very respectfully to the industry that I love, but supermarkets are not the cool guys. These are really run by a bunch of old white guys, and frankly, they haven't, you know, kept up with what's going on, which is why Amazon taking over Whole Foods is so important, because they think very differently. You're going to see, you know, the staff of Whole Foods, the executive team at Whole Foods, be a lot of different kinds of thinkers from Silicon Valley that we haven't seen in the grocery business, you know, for decades.
Katie, you agree with that?
Yes, and I would also add that a lot of the stores that we see under construction are not your typical 40,000 square foot. I'm trying to think of an example of that. I mean, there aren't even that many being built in the Charlotte area of, like, just Harris Teeter. But if you look at, like, the one on South Boulevard that just opened, I think that's 53,000 square feet, which is much larger than a typical Harris Teeter. The one in Pinehurst is, like, 75,000 square feet, which is giant. And then some of the other newer players to the market, like Lidl, Aldi is redoing a bunch of their stores, too, which are very similar. They're smaller format. And they have a lot smaller of a selection. And a lot of that selection is like private label, which is, you know, their own Aldi brand or whatever. So there are, it's either like much more simple and easy to navigate, straightforward, or it's these ritzy super grocery stores. And there's not much in between. So I think that those are the two directions that we're seeing.
That was Katie Peralta from the Charlotte Observer. Phil Lempert, an industry analyst, is also with us. We're talking about going to the grocery store with all the competition heating up. This is Eric Spanberg in for Mike Collins, and you're listening to Charlotte Talks.
More Charlotte Talks in just a moment on Listener Funded, 90.7 WFAE. Our support comes from WFAE members and Jesse Browns, a specialty outfitter offering clothing, gear, and accessories for outdoor adventures or casual trips around town. Located at Sharon Corners at South Park. More info at jessebrowns.com. And Charlotte Radiology, the imaging experts since 1967, celebrating 50 years of subspecialized radiology care. Coming up next on WFAE at 10 o'clock on Point with guest host Ray Suarez in for Tom Ashbrook today, it's disabled children and the Senate health plan. The Senate health care bill would leave millions of disabled children without Medicaid. The show will dig into that coming up next at 10 o'clock on Point here on 90.7 WFAE.
Tom Chester, General Manager, Tyndall Subaru of Gastonia, a WFAE underwriter. there's a lot of listeners, and it's a very high quality type of programming, and we like being associated with that high quality type of approach to news and information.
Get more information. Email underwriting@wfae.org.
Back on Charlotte Talks, I'm Eric Spanberg in for Mike Collins, and my guests are Katie Peralta of the Charlotte Observer, and on the phone we have supermarket analyst Phil Limpert. We're talking about the grocery wars, and I think both of you mentioned in the first segment Amazon and buying, obviously, Whole Foods and all the speculation about what that $14 billion deal might do to the industry. So, Katie, let's start with you. What do you think this means locally for shoppers in Charlotte?
For Whole Foods shoppers or for Amazon shoppers?
For the overall grocery sector, because it seems like there's such a ripple effect.
Sure. So competition is supposed to lead to lower prices, and that might take a little bit, might take a while to happen. But at the same time, I think if you even like logged onto Twitter the day that Amazon bought Whole Foods, you would see people were talking about drones delivering your organic oats and things like that, and all kinds of speculation about what kind of technology Amazon will bring to the Whole Foods market. But I think that there really is something to be said about the technology that they'll bring to delivery and to ordering online. And because Amazon competes with everyone on prices, I think that it's really natural to expect lower prices from that deal. And that's something that's been killing Whole Foods for years now. I mean, as Harris Teeter, as Publix, Wegmans, a lot of the more upscale grocers have gone into like organics and natural food. They're kind of trouncing on Whole Foods territory. So Whole Foods has been forced to respond in whatever way that they can. And they did it in other markets with this 365 concept, which wasn't in Charlotte, but it's been met with kind of mixed reviews. But long story short, I do think we can expect lower prices. I think we can expect cooler technology. Whether or not you shop online already for groceries, I think that maybe some of the things that they bring to market might prompt some people to gravitate toward that. And how long that takes, who knows?
Phil, before I ask you for the sort of the broader implications, particularly when we look at labor, Katie, I want to check, there are three Whole Foods now and a fourth being built in Uptown. Is that right?
Right across from our office.
Right. Yes. But, are there three open right now? Is that right?
Yeah. I think it's Waverly, South Charlotte, and Huntersville.
Yeah. Okay. That's what I thought. So you would know better than me. So, Phil, what do you think in terms of the broader context for not only what it does with the customer experience, but what it does on the labor side?
Well, keep in mind that Amazon has a few things that they're going to do probably right away. Number one, as Katie said, lowering prices. Amazon is known for low prices. They're very efficient operators. So that whole paycheck, symbolism, if you would, is gone. So they're going to lower prices first. The second thing to understand is there's now about 100 Amazon depots around the country that serve, for deliveries. Now with Whole Foods, they have another 461 depots. So what's going to happen with those stores is, first of all, they're going to put in their lockers. So you're going to see Amazon lockers at all the stores. And second, for Amazon Fresh, for their delivery program, it's going to ramp them up very quickly. Amazon on delivery has had two problems, produce and meat. Those are stellar at Whole Foods. So that gets completely eradicated. Also, 90% of Amazon Prime members, who frankly are Whole Foods shoppers, live within 10 miles of a Whole Foods market. So that dynamic is really interesting, both for delivery as well as going into their stores. And then lastly, again, as Katie said, their technology, whether it's from Amazon Go, whether it's drones and so on, you're going to see incorporated. That's going to take a little bit longer to happen. But I think those other things, as far as the lockers go, as far as the delivery goes, and as far as the prices go, those are going to happen relatively quickly. And that's all great news for consumers. Obviously, there's been a lot of talk about the whole labor situation. I don't think people are going to be losing their jobs at all. Certainly, Amazon is very much into robotics, and for their delivery, yes, that'll happen. For their pickup, that'll happen. But you know, they're not going to kill the golden goose that Whole Foods has. Let's remember, even though John Mackey has not done as great as he should have over the past few years, Whole Foods is a great retailer. And now by having Amazon and Amazon's new way of looking at grocery incorporated in it, it's going to be a terrific grocery store.
John Mackey, of course, the CEO of Whole Foods. We've talked a lot about, obviously, Kroger and Publix and Whole Foods. We haven't talked a lot about Walmart, which I think is about 20% of the national grocery market. How is Walmart attacking this ramped-up competition? Let's start with Katie Peralta from The Observer in terms of what we're seeing locally. I think they're closing a few of their neighborhood markets, right, around town?
I think there's one that closed locally. Yeah. And these neighborhood market concepts are a few years old now, and they at one point were expanding rather rapidly around the country with these markets, and it's basically just Walmart's answer to like the traditional grocery store. You know, it's like a 40,000 square foot, you know, kind of like the dinosaur Phil was just talking about. So maybe that's why they weren't doing so well. But Walmart supercenters, especially if they're kind of the only player in their area, seem to still dominate. I'm thinking of like the one on Wilkinson Boulevard, which is like the only grocery store for miles and miles, and it serves a very large community. So they've kind of gone several different routes, right? And so they also have Sam's Club, excuse me, I just blanked on that. So they do have several different concepts that they've responded with and that they are still doing fairly well with. Walmart remains one of the top grocers in the Charlotte area.
The number two, is that right?
I think number two last year. They'll never compete directly with a Whole Foods or with a Harris Teeter, but they are still the leader in low-price grocers.
Phil, what do you see Walmart doing?
Well, Walmart clearly wants to get into the e-commerce game with Jet.com and JetFresh, which is their, you know, delivery of fresh foods. That's where I really think that they're going to pull ahead. I agree that when we take a look at the formats, whether it's Sam's, whether it's the supercenters and so on, those are stable, those are growing depending on where they are in the country. But the big expansion is going to be in e-commerce with Jet.com and JetFresh when it comes to groceries.
So obviously there's a grocery store with a lot of local heritage that we haven't talked at all about, which is Food Lion, and the parent company may or may not be in play, right, with Kroger. There was some rumor about that, I think. Where does Food Lion fit in the Charlotte market, first of all, at this point?
I think technically speaking, if we're looking at market share, it's number three it's number three. And they're based in Salisbury, or rather Food Lion is their parent company, is European. But they've always been a pretty competitive grocer in the Charlotte market, and they just redid all of their grocery stores in the area with, you know, fresh imagery, fresh the store layouts are much more easy to navigate now. They've redone their entire fresh produce department with a, like, walk-in fruit closet, things like that. So they've invested very heavily. It's an over $200 million project that they did, and this is basically in response to all the competition that's entering the market.
But they're not going in that grocerant, to use your term.
No, and they're much more simplified. They don't have, like Walmart has, like the order online, pick up in store. To my knowledge, they don't have like the delivery directly operated through Food Lion, and they don't have the in store restaurants. So it is a much more simplified shopper experience. So that's certainly something that makes them a little bit different. But they're one that have been here for decades.
So, Phil Limpert, what do you see with Food Lion in terms of their staying power and their impact?
Well, I think that they're floundering. And, you know, what they did, now about 15 years ago, is they had started that concept by the name of Bloom, which was really very clever and really very insightful. And they just missed the mark. They were one of the first retailers to really jump on technology, to really focus on food. And for whatever reason, you know, Bloom didn't bloom. You know, they turned them back into Food Lion. Food Lion has always been known for great prices, and I think a lot of the activity that you're seeing now is they're trying to expand that and have a lot of these service departments. But again, for me, a lot of their stores is that dinosaur model that they really need to change drastically if they want to stay in the business.
The Kroger CEO on an analyst call recently was discussing the price pressure on milk and eggs, which are obviously staples at any grocery store. I'm wondering, particularly Katie, since you're reporting on the local market. How much price sensitivity? I know that sounds like a ridiculous question. Of course, everybody wants to pay less, but how much is that driving customers back and forth? You know, how much do you think people are shuffling around just based on prices?
I really think it depends on the age group, and I hate to lean back on generalizations about different age groups, but being a millennial myself, I know that there are things that are, you know, there's data behind this. You know, we go for the cheapest and most convenient locations, whereas maybe a baby boomer or like a family might go to the Harris Teeter down the street that they've gone to for years. You know, they like the brand, they like the customer service there, they're used to it.
Guilty. Go ahead.
Well, see, proving
I'm confirming
my point.
Stereotypes. Go ahead.
So I think that there are a lot of different spending habits that play into that, and so I think that some grocers like, even Food Lion, but Harris Teeter, Publix, I was thinking of, are really trying to build up that brand loyalty among millennials. You know, they're building in very millennial heavy areas in Charlotte and beyond. But I think that we are much more sensitive to price. And for us, it's going to be a lot more what's convenient for me. You know, I'm going to drop in and pick up a whatever on my way home from work. And I also don't want to spend an arm and a leg every time I go in there. So I think that those are probably the two most important factors.
So, Phil Limpert, how complicated does that make life for not only the Krogers, but the other so-called traditional grocery stores?
Very complicated, and that's why Lidl and Aldi really have a jump on this market, especially for millennials who are passionate about food. They want quality, but as Katie said, they want value, and that's what Lidl and Aldi have. 90% of what they sell is under their own brands. Lidl, since January, has won over 200 different awards, medals for their wines here in the U.S. They're pushing hard to build a relationship with that millennial shopper that really is going to steal them away from the Krogers, from the Harris Teeters, from the Safeways of the world, from all those traditional grocers.
Well, what about those non-millennials of us? How long before we catch on to the smarter shopping that the millennials might be doing?
I don't know if we ever do. I'm a baby boomer also. And when you think about long-term planning, and what I'm going to say is going to come under a lot of criticism, but for us, for baby boomers, we've got probably about another 20 or 30 years worth of grocery shopping until we die. When you look at millennials, they've got another 50, 60 years till they die, if not longer. That's why the focus is really on the millennials, on Generation Z, because if you can grab them now as they earn more money, as they get, more family building and so on, what you're going to have is you're going to have a better customer than somebody who's, 70, 80, 90 years old.
So, Katie, when we look at Charlotte, what about the other players? You know, you have Target, you obviously have the other wholesalers like Costco and BJ's, and you have Trader Joe's, some of those. How are they sort of factoring in, I guess, to these grocery wars that we tend to think of as really Harris Teeter versus Publix?
They're much smaller. That's why we think of them as Harris Teeter versus Publix, especially when you look at the wholesalers. I don't know offhand how big of a market share they command, but Trader Joe's, for example, is very deliberate about where they build stores. And I hear people talking all the time, why don't we have a Trader Joe's in my area? And I think that I'm not sure about the rationale behind those decisions. Maybe, Phil, you could speak to this, but those kind of markets really are appealing to millennials because they're smaller, they're simpler, they're really cheap, and they're conveniently located. So those all play a much smaller role in Charlotte's grocery wars, but at the same time, a lot of them have been here for years. You know, they have a loyal customer base. They're not necessarily trying to dominate the industry. I think if you look at, Target. Target's not trying to become the dominant grocery store in the country, I don't think. So I think that for them it's sort of slow and steady, I guess.
And then you have somebody like Earth Fare, their CEO just did an interview with one of my colleagues, and I think they had just opened their fifth store, right, in the area. And he was talking about expanding in Charlotte, but, is that the kind of thing that Whole Foods worries about? I mean, I know big scale they don't, but in Charlotte, do they worry about someone like that?
I think so. They did have a pretty aggressive expansion plan like several years ago. And remember when their stock price was really starting to kind of hit the brakes a little bit? I guess it was last year. We wondered whether some of their planned locations in Charlotte, like the Uptown one, would still open. And by the way, yes, it is. It's almost done. But I think that they are probably going to be much more deliberate about brick-and-mortar locations. When you look at you know, traditional retail, we say these days that we're probably overstored and overmulled in the U.S. So I wonder when that's going to be true of grocery stores, too. Eventually, we won't need all of these grocery stores to keep expanding.
Yeah, I want to ask you that, Phil Limpert. We have a couple minutes left, and I just wonder, you know, how much can we eat? I mean, these things are opening all over Charlotte and every other growing city. I mean, we see the same pattern playing out. So when does this endless expansion come to a halt?
Well, you're right. We're not eating more. We're eating differently than we ever did. So the choices are becoming more important. And what we're starting to see is retailers, and Whole Foods has done this for a while, as well as some other ones. But the bottom line is they're starting to curate their offerings. So it's not going into a store and seeing 100 different bottles of olive oil, but frankly, 8 different brands of olive oil, you know, an organic one, one from France, one from, you know, Tunisia that has an Italian name on it, one from California. So we're getting more particular in actually what we are, what we're buying. And, you know, we are overstored when it comes to groceries, but we're getting more segmented. So I'm going to go to Lidl to get certain things. I'm going to go to Harris Teeter to get certain things. We're really shopping around more than ever before.
So the good news is we can all go to 7 grocery stores a week instead of 1.
Exactly.
I don't know if that's great news, but it is the news. So Phil Limpert, supermarket industry analyst, thank you for joining us. Katie Peralta
thank
from
you.
The Charlotte Observer, thank you for joining us. And also Edwin Peacock and Dan McCorkle earlier in the hour with the political races. I'm Eric Spanberg, in for Mike Collins. Thanks for listening today.